This is the Radio Walensky Podcast. I'm Richard Walensky with new and archive interviews from the Probabilities and Bookwaves Art Waves programs on KPFA-FM and Pacifica Syndication. My guest is Colm Tobin, whose latest novel is Long Island. I believe that is the 13th book of fiction, and there's also 10 books of nonfiction, 3 plays, a book of poetry. The current book, newest novel, is Long Island, which could be called a sequel to Brooklyn, but it takes place 20 years later and involves many of the same characters, and I would assume was not originally thought about at all, that the book was done after Brooklyn. Other books include Nora Webster, The Magician, The Master, and 2 other books set in the same location, 2 novels of Enniscarthy, which are the Wexford novels, The Heather Blazing and The Blackwater Lightship, which were written in the 90s. So let's go back to the last time I spoke with you, which was around the time of Testament of Mary. I think I interviewed you for Nora Webster at ACT.
All right, okay.
So they were simultaneous.
Okay.
What brought you to write about Thomas Mann?
I suppose when I was a teenager, in my late teens, at that time when you start buying your own books, or, you know, not reading books that your parents want you to read or that are on courses, I read, was very fashionable in university to read Thomas Mann, to read especially The Magic Mountain. So I read The Magic Mountain. I would have seen the movie of Death in Venice. I read other books by Thomas Mann, including Dr. Faustus and Buddenbrooks. And I became interested later on, much later on, in the distance between the sort of figure he presented to the world and the figure he was. In other words, the distance between the man and the mind, between the, you know, the very formal, sophisticated, slightly distant, erudite figure and the shivering, you know, man who really was a much more wavering and ambiguous figure than anyone thought. And we know this from his diaries, basically from his diaries, but also from the memoirs around him, his children's version of what the domestic life was like. And he was a great figure in the domestic world. I mean, he was not a person who went out to cafes. He wasn't part of that world of old Munich. It was very much living in a rather grand houses, staying in his library, going for walks, a sort of patrician, conservative figure. And I was interested in seeing what I could do if that broke up.
In a book like Long Island, which we'll get to, it's clear from what you've said about the book, particularly in the New York Times, that when you start it, it's an idea, and then you just go with it and see where it leads, and it could lead anywhere. But when you're writing a book like The Magician or The Master, you have to be dealing with certain facts. It's like you've got a pre-existing outline. How do you maneuver that and still keep your freedom?
With the Henry James story, for example, there are 11 chapters in my novel, The Master. If you gave the same material to anyone, the vast material we have about Henry James, because his brother wrote, his sister wrote, there's a biography of his father, a biography of his 2 brothers. There's a huge amount. Anyone, I think, will come up with different details, a different story. So it isn't as though it's preordained in that sense. You can take anything you want. You could take 5 years of his early life. You could take, you know, just 1 month, you know. So with that, I think that you really are doing a lot of choosing and sifting and designing. So it doesn't seem that much preordained. Obviously, you're following facts, but you could go to another set of facts from another decade of his life. So in that sense, you are working very much in control.
And with The Magician?
With The Magician, it was different, because every time I tried to do what I'd done with The Master, which would take a 5-year period, or every time I tried to do what I'd done with my novel, The Heather Blazing, which does 1 chapter is the present, 1 chapter is the past, and you move along, you know, over a period of time with both timescales. With the man, you can't do either of these things, because the First World War has to occur as a surprise. no one thought in July 1914 that there was going to be a war. And so too with the rise of Hitler. Therefore, you have to bring things along chronologically in that dull, plodding way that, say, biographers can use very fruitfully. You know, and then, and then, and then. Right. 1918 led to 1919. And it's not a novel. It's not a natural habitat for novelists that 1918 led to 1919. Novelists should be able to manipulate or play with those sort of ideas of chronology. But with this story, I felt you couldn't. That you would lose the idea of surprise. You would lose the idea of not surprise as much as what's not expected, what's not presumed, and therefore you had to bring him through his life. He dramatized his life chronologically. So it's a very different structure and system than that is used in the Master.
But in that case, where does Colm Tóibín come in? I mean, where do you create your own space within that context?
You know, I think that the first thing you must do is be ready to do a pretty violent self-suppression. In other words, that you're of no interest here, that the page is not a mirror, it is blank. And once you get over that idea, you know, that you're not really attempting a self-portrait and that the self, the actual composing self, is merely there almost as a conduit, but certainly to make things that look as though they are dealing with a separate reality than the reality that is known or is experienced by the writer. However, as you work, things come into play, almost despite your best efforts, that don't seem at the beginning relevant, but that by the end of the book, you have in some way or other produced a sort of self-portrait without meaning to. But it's a self-portrait that is often of things concealed, of things half hidden, so that no one else might be aware of the extent of that self-portrait, which began with self-suppression, began with smudging, blurring, leaving things out, and ended with something the opposite of that.
Have biographers talked to you about it afterward?
No, I've not heard from any of the... I mean, I know Jean Strauss, who's the great biographer of Alice Jane, which is a marvelous book, but I don't think Jean and myself have ever talked about, you know, how we diverge or how we... The biographer I'm closest to is Roy Foster, the great biographer of Yeats, and the great two-volume biographer, which I really rate as a... You know, as a novelist, looking at that, you see there isn't biographer's art. And it is perhaps best, you know, defined as how intelligent is this biographer? And the answer is with Roy Foster, I mean, supremely intelligent. And so you're watching an intelligence at work, not sifting the facts or change, you know, but actually putting together the available information with superb analysis. I'm pretty impressed by that. You know, in other words, it's not as I'm saying the novelist's art is a higher form of art. I think the biographer's art at its best can be extraordinary, as in the Leon Udell biographies of James. I don't think there's a biography of Thomas Mann that matches that.
Somewhere in there, the pandemic happened.
With The Magician, the great thing about the pandemic was that the book was finished. And I had lovely time to read the book, merely to just every so often, maybe every few weeks, in a period of, say, 6 months, I would take the book out again and I would read it. And in doing that, I saw that a great deal could go. I saw a story, I saw an arc, I saw a sort of set of threads. And I realized that anything that isn't part of those threads is boring. I mean, boring, just simply not needed, just simply right. Can go. And the thing is, take it out now. If anything occurs to you to take it out. Read the book again 3 weeks later to see if you miss it. And I found there was never a time that I did. It needed, sometimes the book needed something else. It needed something added elsewhere. But in that stuff that I took out quite a lot. It was just gone.
So you actually were able to use the pandemic in a way you might not have been willing to.
The pandemic was a very fruitful time for me, the pandemic, in that I began to write poems again, revised poems. I did all the work on The Magician. And then I wrote the first part of Long Island.
Well, let's talk about Long Island. Obviously, Brooklyn was finished. There'd been a movie. And then something happened. You said in the Times interview that a scene came to you. How did that happen? And how did you realize that's another book?
it happens sometimes that something absolutely occurs to you from nowhere. In other words, you are somewhere walking along, getting off a plane or on a train, and something comes to you. And that's the opening three or four pages of Long Island. And I would have thought it was too dramatic, too openly sort of colorful. But I entertained it, and then I wrote it down. Once I did that, I had a book. And the job was then how to make the rest of the book work in the light of those opening three pages of the book. I hadn't done that. I hadn't had that problem before.
I'm trying to remember the first three pages.
Well, the first three pages are where it's revealed. The yeah. Irishman comes and says what he says.
What happened to me is I picked the book up and I wound up not being able to put it down and read in a day and a half, which I don't do. So you did something, and I'm not sure how you did it, to create a page turner. And that wasn't even in your mind, I guess.
You know, it was on my mind because once I'd written the opening, once the idea it comes, this book is going to open with a plot, with a moment of action. The rest of the book is going to be the consequences of that. And I'm going to look at how this was dealt with by Thomas Hardy in Mary Casterbridge. Which I was, you see, I'm teaching these books. I'm doing seminars on these books. Okay. So I'm coming home and I'm reading things again. I'm not looking at much criticism, but I am looking at some of the writing about Thomas Hardy. Thomas Hardy's Mary Casterbridge. Joseph Conrad's Victory. Edith Wharton's The Age of Innocence. Henry James's The Golden Bowl. So I'm looking at how this business of plot, P-L-O-T, is being dealt with by novelists in the 19th century. In other words, to have a plot, you have to have an action. And that action then must lead to consequences which are not predictable. But it can't just be the action, and the consequences can't just die out on a dying fall. They lead and they lead and they lead to things, and the reader has to follow that. So it's a certain sort of novel based on a 19th century form. And it is not meditative. It is not about creating an atmosphere. It is not about character. It is that each thing everyone does has to lead towards the next thing. Not just that an action will occur and people will go, say, to the beach. That beach scene will not be there to create an atmosphere of a beach. It will be to show something that will lead to something else. And so that the way time is passing, the way each thing is being told, all of it is part of a pattern that is about the idea of plot. So yeah, when you say page turner, I'm interested because I'm trying to get that idea that nothing in this book happens without a reason. In other words, it's almost like a jigsaw, but it's not exactly a jigsaw because it's propulsion. You're propelling the thing. It's almost like that you're giving energy to the thing by each scene, but nothing is there by chance. And in the readings of the book, when I was reading the book myself, I would cut anything that didn't automatically lead, wasn't part of the thread or the pattern or the propulsion.
To some degree, that also meant that every couple of pages, you're also going to throw in potential Chekhov's guns.
Yeah, I suppose that's true. That, in other words, when there's a moment where after all the years in America, where Elisha's home in Ireland, and of course she goes for a walk, and I try and make that natural. It's the reason why she will walk out at night and the street will be empty and she will see Jim Farrell, who will be standing outside his pub. Now, my job is to make that natural. Once that occurs, then I have to give Jim Farrell a huge backstory. Like what has been happening? We know it's been happening to Eilish because that's the first section of the book, Long Island, right, over the last 25 years. What's been happening to him? Now, you have to do that carefully in that don't put too much in. You don't need to put all the stuff about his parents in. You just have to give him one or two stories that show you how he's been living. And you have to do that very carefully, because if you put it in that it's if it's too interesting, it will become the plot. You don't want a second plot going. So you can't have it too interesting, but it must be interesting enough that it shows you something. It gives you a sense of what's now about to occur, has a context.
I'm not sure whether to give the spoiler of the first three pages.
Oh, you can do that, Jeff.
Okay.
Yeah.
The first three pages, we meet our character, Eilish, who is from Brooklyn, only now it's 20 years later, the end of Brooklyn. The family that she's married into are buying property on Long Island, and now it's 20 years later. She has two kids. same husband, living on a cul-de-sac with the rest of the family. A man shows up at her doorstep saying, "Your husband impregnated my wife. I don't want the kid. I'm dropping him off on your doorstep." What is she going to do? That propulsion is there throughout the book, but what you do when she goes back to Ireland to figure things out, what you do is you add another propulsion right on top of the first, which we can't talk about. So there are two propulsions going on in the second half of the book.
Yeah. But what I think I'm doing, what I'm trying to do is that the propulsion from that the plot, the consequences of the first thing you've just described, go right through the book without being mentioned much. In other words, it's not as though every page has the baby, what will happen, or the man who came. But nonetheless, the reader is constantly aware that this time bomb is ticking, that this woman in America is going to have this baby. And so as other things are happening in Ireland, the reader is alert to the undercurrent. So the initial event hits the whole book, and everything is a result of it. In other words, she would not go back to Ireland without it. She goes back to Ireland with only that on her mind. So that no matter what you're dealing with the results of that. Obviously, what you're trying to do is create consequences that are not entirely predictable and that are not just the result of something that might seem somehow free-flowing, but there are consequences nonetheless. So that's the idea of the book.
Jennifer Egan, in a review of Nora Webster, noted, that was also, I think, in the Times, noted that one thing you did is you never went fully into Nora's head. Now, you do that with Eilish, and yet at the same time, you pull back every time so that we don't really know what she's thinking.
Yeah, there are moments when you feel right, and I feel this is a moment where Eilish can start really thinking. But what I'm trying to do once the first section is done is that each thing is told from three perspectives, from three different characters, one of them being just one of them being Eilish. So you get what happens to her, but then you get someone else's version of that, which of course is entirely different, or at least a different perspective shows you something different. So yeah, I'm working all the time with knowledge, with how little you know, how little she knows, how little someone else knows, and the idea of secrecy then and what's hidden and what's implied.
You do a couple of other things, one of which is you end a chapter or whatever you want to call it, and then you pick up, well, we're waiting for the answer. We've sort of already got it, and then you go back and tell us what happened.
Yeah.
So that we're propelled forward that way.
Yeah, there's a lot of technical work to do with how much. And it's fun sometimes because you think, okay, if I stop this here and show it from someone else's point of view, you're going to learn really what Eilish needed to know and didn't know. Or in one of the other characters, that can happen too. There's a wedding. Now, I'm not going to say whose wedding or why the wedding, but the wedding is told from two people who were at the wedding from their side. So it looks like a happy occasion, the bridegroom, all have been dancing and singing. And then you get it from the second perspective, you realize there's something else going on at this wedding. And if you've ever been at an event like that, and someone says to you 10 years later, but did you not see, did you not notice that so-and-so wasn't in the room at that moment, and so-and-so else wasn't in the room, did you never see that? And you say, no, I was dancing, I was happy. Well, that's what you should have been watching, you know. And so there are many occasions in our lives. I don't know if you've ever seen it where you're in a bar with friends and you notice someone watching somebody else. Or you see you're at a dinner and you see, ha, I didn't realize that, you know. And it's that sort of idea that there are two ways of looking at an event. First, happy on the surface, and the other one from another perspective. So I've been sort of, and it's not, in a way, it's not hard to do that as long as you watch it yourself. You read it over at night when you've written it. You read it in the morning, which is much colder perspective you have. Cutting back all the time. If you don't need to know things, just cut them out and leave it pretty spare. Because the one thing you don't want to do if you're doing something twice is start boring the reader with the boring details a second time.
When you were working on the first draft, was that in your mind, or were you kind of creating a straightforward narrative?
You see, the first section was written was much longer. I cut it back. But the first section, which is all happens in Long Island, was written in the pandemic, and I left it for about a year to try and work out how the next part of the book would proceed.
So the next part of the book was kind of figured out in your head before you began writing it.
That's correct. Yeah, I would tend to do that. I don't, little details will occur to me as I'm working and new ways to do things, but the general overall sense of it, I do in advance. Yeah.
So it's really thought out. I mean, there's nothing in the book isn't there for a reason.
There's a lot of control applied. Yeah.
How did you feel doing that when books like Nora Webster don't necessarily have that control?
It was a sort of relief to do it new. In other words, it wasn't to be Nora Webster again. You see, the worry is that you'll get a sort of sameness in that, yes, she comes home to Ireland. Yes, we can see all the things that might happen. I mean, unless she becomes an opera singer or runs off to, you know, like you really are constrained by the way her mind works. But if you bring in two other characters, then you can get an energy that you won't get with the sole one. I wouldn't want to have done it with Nora Webster because I wanted it to be a single perspective, very slow, meditative, without any necessarily any action, really, just what it was like for two or three years to go by in someone's life. I mean, really as simple as that. But with this one, it was entirely, I suppose it was a much more calculating, cold scalpel applied to everything to get it into shape.
One question that came up many, many years ago, and I probably previous interviews might have asked you about it. My old late partner, Dick Lupoff, used to talk about the difference between creation and discovery. And for you, Colm Tobin, what's going on? Is it creating? Are you discovering something? How does that work for you?
I suppose I'm creating in that what I'm watching all the time is where the emotion lies, not putting in too much, but trying to get it also to that with this one, a sort of surprise, which might be a sort of discovery. One of the characters then begins to take over the novel. So that it begins with Eilish, but it doesn't end with her. The discovery was really how make that gradual, and it became gradual for me, that I could see Jim Farrell much more clearly as the book went on. I think writing that initial thing of him having a long night, not a long night of the soul, but a long night where he has seen Eilish for the first time in 25 years, and he goes out, sits up late, and he goes over everything that happened. Now, I'm using so many literary sources for this stuff.
Right.
That's, you know, in Portrait of a Lady, Elizabeth Archer stays up through the night going over things. Now, she recognizes and sees something that Jim really doesn't. But nonetheless, I'm trying to get the same pacing of what happens if someone went upstairs and had a drink and 3 or 4 hours later, they're still going over things. But you have to get that in maybe 20 pages. That's all you have, really. I mean, maybe even 15. And you have to get that sense of the night passing, of the mind going over certain things that are unresolved, you know. Some of that's discovery, because what you start doing is discovering the character who becomes interesting for you as the writer, and then you can do more with them.
Well, we haven't mentioned the third character in this, Nancy, Eilish's best friend, who we will learn fits into the story. She comes in pretty late in the second half as a point of view character, and it seemed to me that she kind of pushed her way in, if that makes sense.
She appears first in a story in a book, my book, Mothers and Sons, which I wrote in the summer of 2001, called The Name of the Game. I just love the idea of trying to get a novel going. We're trying to get a rich emotional life going for these characters who, for example, they don't mention reading books. They don't. There's no great glamour attached to running a chip shop,
and there's no politics.
No, it was vital for me. 1976 is a great year because it's the great thing in America.
Right.
Is for every novel, it's a great gift. Is Gerald Ford.
There is mention of Nixon.
Yes, but the novel is set after Nixon.
No,
you don't bring in its aftermath. Who's in charge now is Gerald Ford, and Gerald Ford is a lovely time for novelists because he's almost nobody. You know, Betty Ford has more color than Gerald Ford. I mean, and so it's between Nixon and Jimmy Carter. And so it's a lovely time for novelists because you can let the characters bloom and blossom and fall in love and fall out of love without feeling you have to bring in all this stuff, Vietnam War or you know, or the Iran, you know, the Ayatollah, or, you know, they can just let this thing happen outside a political world. And that might seem unlikely in Ireland, but by 1976, in a town like Enniscorthy, in the southeast of Ireland, the North did not impinge every day in the way that it had, say, 5 years earlier. It was as though people got used to the idea there were car bombs and there was British soldiers. And it's possible to have a full novel without having to go into it, in which it wouldn't have been true 5 years earlier, and wouldn't have been true 5 years later because it would have been the hunger strikes. This is a funny interregnum, a funny vacuum, a funny neutral time where certain emotions can flourish, such as love, jealousy, treachery.
And it's kind of lucky that she's exactly the right age for that to happen.
Yeah, but I was determined not to. There in drafts of the book, there were times when there was much more about, you know, politics and things were mentioned, but I just wanted less and less of it.
Enniscorthy, the town, now that's where you grew up and where you left, but you go back to Wexford and that area frequently. So by setting it there, you could bring Nora Webster in a little cameo, but you also don't have to do much research because you know the area so well.
Yeah, 1976, when the novel Long Island is set, is also probably the last summer that I was around Enniscorthy in a sort of natural way. And therefore, I have a real sense of that. The topography is correct. In other words, if I say a street is called this, it is. And if you turn right, you get that street, it is. That's all, you know, so that all of that is intense, you know, not research, but just, it isn't even memory. It's just, I know it.
So her chip shop is in the main square, Market Square. His bar is up a block somewhere. Is that right?
Yeah, there are a lot of bars named in the book. The Antique Tavern, which is real. Stamps, which is real. The Club, which is real. Larkin's, which is real. This pub, Jim's, is the only fictional space, you know, and the chip shop. But I mean, I needed a pub in a particular place. There is not a pub exactly there. So that's nice.
Did you spend any time looking up who won particular rugby games or whatever appears?
No, I didn't do any. I didn't want to go into, I mean, I could have gone into the details, especially over hurling or football, but it's more that it's a time of ease as well, where there would have been a decade earlier tensions between the people who played rugby wouldn't play hurling, but that was no longer the case by 76.
I'd like to ask you a little bit about the books that were turned into films. In particular, when I was doing my research, there was a film of the Blackwater Lightship with Angela Lansbury, which actually somebody could watch if they look up a streamer called Hallmark Movie Now. Do you have any work with that particular film?
Hallmark bought the rights to my novel, The Blackwater Lightship, and then nothing happened for a long time, and I was assured it really wasn't something they were likely to make. And then very suddenly, they announced they were going to make it. And they cast Angela Lansbury and they cast Diane Wiest as daughter and mother, both Irish. It's a marvelous film. But you see, because it didn't open with any fanfare, it was before all the Netflix stuff, so it was merely made for Hallmark Television at a time before such things were being made for television. It had no life in the cinema. I mean, it wasn't made for the cinema, and made for television. There's about half an hour in the middle where Angela Lansbury and Diane Wiest and an English actress called Gina McKee have an extraordinary argument with each other. That's like, it really is something like something out of Bergman. And I was amazed by it. And I had a very nice time. I didn't write the screenplay and I didn't take part in it. But I was around a bit and I enjoyed it.
And Brooklyn, your involvement with Brooklyn.
It was a bit more with involvement with Brooklyn because, I didn't write the screenplay. And again, I mean, Nick Hornby wrote the screenplay and he did a very good job. And we weren't in touch as he was working. You know, it would have been, I mean, he didn't want my involvement and I understood that. And then when it was done, I met him to thank him. And there were two words I wanted changed and that was all fine. He wrote a new ending, which I liked, which I saw the point of. wouldn't have worked for the novel, but it was fine for the film. And then I went up. They were shooting in Montreal, and I was in New York, so I went up, and I got a little cameo role. I was the fellow going into America just before Saoirse Ronan. So that was nice because we had to do about 10 takes, and I was standing. We got to talk a lot, and it was really very nice to meet her and be around her.
And you're happy with the result?
Yeah, it was absolutely. It isn't just that it was painless; it was pleasure.
What was Return to Montauk?
Return to Montauk. I wrote the screenplay with Volker Schlondorf, who is best known in America for The Tin Drum, which he directed. So he won an Oscar for that. You know, it began as a strange project to take the Max Frisch novel called Montauk, which is a very strange novel about a journey by road from New York out to Montauk and the things that occurred to the writer on his way out. We took that and then we didn't end up using any of it, really. And then it became about the visit of a German writer to New York and a sort of sexual comedy, which Volker myself wrote and which Stellan Skarsgård played. You know, that's my only outing, really, as a screenwriter.
How did you get involved?
I'm friends with Volker. We've been friends for a long time. We would see one another in the summers. So really, it was this almost natural thing that we were making jokes about films. And then Volker said, why don't we have a go at this? And yeah, that was really, it was just a friend. It was, yeah, we were good friends. Yeah.
There's also two documentaries on IMDb. One is called Untamable, and the other is Jack B. Yates.
Yeah.
How'd you get involved with those?
There are these young filmmakers in Ireland, and they were working on a documentary on Jack Yates. It was a simple question. They asked me if I would write the script, and I absolutely jumped at it because A, it was out of my comfort zone, B, it was during the pandemic, and C, it's a subject that fascinated me. Not only, you know, they were going to do the visuals, and I began to trust them that they knew what they were doing with all that. And all my job was really to give them a sort of, well, a script that I would be ready to rewrite the script. You know, there could be cut, it could be, it was a collaboration. And the second one was they did a documentary on bogland, on uses of bog in Ireland, and the not the controversies around it as much as how this had evolved. And again, it was a subject that interested me, and I set to work. And so I did I wrote script for two documentaries, and I have to say that was a very happy experience.
And that was during the pandemic, so the
first one was Jack Yates one was, and the bog one came after.
So during the pandemic, you were on Zoom a lot.
Yeah, I had rich days, you know, because it's a lovely idea waking in the morning, morning after morning, to feel that I will not be going out today. There will be no social life, and there will be no travel, and there will be no going to the cinema. All those crutches, you know, just the whole day will probably be spent in the house or in the garden. And then, you know, when it got into the summer, you got these long summer days in Los Angeles, especially. Beautiful weather. And, you know, I would just set about writing, really.
Colm Tobin, what are you working on now?
Well, I have an opera. I've written a libretto for it's a new story about the Abbey Theatre going to America, I think in 1911. And it's a comedy. And I've not really written a comedy before. In other words, it's a comedy in which everyone, by the end of the opera, gets married. You know, and there's no dark moment where someone breaks all that up. So it's a short opera. I mean, it's going to be about an hour and 20 minutes, hour and 10 minutes. And it's being performed in Wexford at the Opera Festival in October. So that's done. And I'm trying to write another libretto. I'm trying to write short stories. I'm trying to write poems. I just work. You know, it's nice.
What about a novel?
Yeah, we'll have to start thinking about another novel soon.
Do you ever think you'll return to Ailish and your old hometown?
I don't know.
You've been listening to an interview with Colm Tobin, whose latest novel is titled Long Island, and again, The Blackwater Lightship, you can find streaming through the Hallmark Movie Now network, which you can get through Apple and Amazon. And the documentaries, are they streaming, do you know? Not yet. And of course, Brooklyn is streaming, and you can find it. Special thanks to the folks at Bookshop West Portal for their assistance on this interview. Until next time, I'm Rich Walensky. Radio Walensky usually posts every week on Sundays. You can write to me either at bookwaves@hotmail.com or richard@kpfa.org. You can find other Radio Walensky podcasts in the Area 941 section of kpfa.org, or you can go to bookwaves.homestead.com or richardwalensky.com for a complete listing of all digitized recordings. You can subscribe to Radio Walensky via iTunes or follow Richard Walensky Radio shows on Facebook.